Well, thank you very much, Ken. It's a great honor to be here tonight in Philadelphia with the Philadelphia Society and in the presence of the Founding Fathers, Independence Hall, and in the presence of Forrest MacDonald, who's taught us so much about the Founding Fathers. I'm just here as a journalist, as a sort of hack. The journalist played some role in the founding, I think. Usually it was to spread lies and misinformation about the Founding Fathers in various ways, shapes, and forms, often subsidized by some of them against the other. I like to say that the function that a lot of people don't really understand the proper function of journalists, which is our duty is to prowl the battlefield and shoot the wounded. Perhaps torture them first. We are given an amendment that we share with lobbyists that guarantees our freedom, the First Amendment, and we manage to abuse it 7 days a week. But in any case, it is really an honor to be here, and this is kind of a thrilling moment for me and I think for everybody in the room. And it's a reminder that we stand on the shoulders of giants, and we should remember that they stood on the shoulders of others as well. And I think they were well aware of it. The founders were very much aware of events that occurred about a century before the American Revolution that I tried to describe in my book, Our First Revolution, which Ken made reference to. The subject of that book was an extraordinary series of events in 1688 and 1689, which resulted in the ouster of the Catholic King James II and the installation of the Protestant William and Mary, who also happened to be his daughter and son-in-law. William was also his nephew as well as his son-in-law. These events had profound effects on the then separate kingdoms of England, Scotland, and Ireland, and also on the English colonies here in North America, which less than a century later would become the United States of America. James had been attempting, to kind of try to simplify the narrative, to impose a centralized pro-Catholic continental European government. That may sound familiar, actually, today. Like that of his ally, the great monarch of his age, Louis XIV of France, on English-speaking kingdoms which cherished their heritage of independent local government, parliamentary representation, and Protestant religion. William of Orange, the stadtholder of the Netherlands, assembled a navy that crossed the English Channel in November, not the month usually recommended for channel crossings. Landing, anybody that's crossed the channel in November will appreciate that. An army of 25,000 prompted James to flee, and a parliament made up of previously bitter opponents, the first English political parties, the Tories and the Whigs. Now, both of those terms were actually insults. One were sheep stealers, and the other were cattle stealers, as I remember it. And it carries on a tradition. Americans tried to name their parties after something good, but the English had derogatory terms. And they offered William and his wife the crown. But it came with conditions, and conditions which I think continue to have relevance and reverberate for us today. Formally, the king could summon and dissolve Parliament. Starting with 1689, the king had to summon the Parliament to raise revenue to run the government, and Parliament has met in every year since. Formally, the king could oust local government officials and judges. No more. Parliament passed a Bill of Rights, considerably less capacious than the American Bill of Rights a century later, but still a limitation on executive power. Parliament also passed a Toleration Act, which, while prohibiting Catholics from holding public office, allowed various Protestant sects to flourish in a kind of free market competition with the established Church of England. A kind of competition which prevailed particularly in the North American colonies and which has resulted in the continuing vitality of religion in American life over the succeeding 300 years. Formerly, the king was short of revenue and even accepted secret bribes from Louis XIV. Under King William, the Parliament set up the Bank of England, which provided financial support for England and Britain in its world wars with France, and for the entrepreneurs and inventors who in the next century produced the Industrial Revolution. As a result, Britain, with only one quarter the population of France, prevailed in wars against royal, revolutionary, and Napoleonic French regimes in the 18th and 19th century, and became the economic leader of the world in the mostly peaceful century that followed. In other words, this glorious revolution, named by people that favored it naturally, our first revolution as Americans, in my view, turned out to be a giant step forward for representative government, guaranteed liberties, market capitalism, and a foreign policy opposing tyrannical hegemonic powers that threatened to control the European continent and large parts of the rest of the world. It put the English-speaking peoples on the trajectory that we have followed in the 19th and 20th and now the 21st centuries of leading the world economically and of defeating in war and peace the tyrants of imperial and Nazi Germany, communist Russia, and now the Islamists who seek to destroy our civilization. We in America are lucky to share this tradition and to be its dominant partner, as the Founding Fathers, I think, envisioned. Benjamin Franklin, our first demographer, noting the population growth of the colonies, predicted they would soon have more people than the British Isles, a prediction that turned out to be correct. George Washington, disciplining himself to set precedents that he thought would be followed for hundreds of years, predicted that his nation of 4 million people, as recorded in the 1790 census, would one day have 100 million. And in our 2010 census, which is supposed to measure our population, as of 10 days ago, we are going to be over 300 million. Almost 100 times the population of George Washington's republic. In their struggle for independence, the founders did not renounce their English heritage, but rather complained that they were being deprived of the liberties of Englishmen. They were deeply influenced by, among others, the philosopher John Locke, whose writings were taken as a rationale for the Glorious Revolution and for the American Revolution as well. In the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the founders sought to establish representative government and to guarantee liberties beyond those guaranteed in Britain. In the first years of the Republic, at the prodding of Alexander Hamilton, they established a Bank of the United States. You can see the first Bank of the United States a few blocks away from here, and a funded national debt which financed government in wartime and entrepreneurs and inventors in times of both war and peace. In the 20th century, America joined Britain and became its senior partner in the struggle against tyrannical powers whose depredations and death tolls dwarfed those of Louis XIV and Napoleon. So I think we are part of a tradition here that we celebrate, not only a tradition that goes back some 200 plus years to the American founders, but a tradition that goes back in the English-speaking peoples at least 100 years before. Now, the point is often made that the Founding Fathers do not meet all our contemporary litmus tests. Some of them owned slaves. They did not think of extending the right of vote to women, although widows were allowed to vote in New Jersey, I read. It sets up certain perverse incentives, it seems to me. Perhaps the Sopranos is being relevant there. The founders did not consider the possibility of same-sex marriage or debate the role of gays in the military, although there may have been some at that time. They did not, nor did they contemplate a reform considered progressive 90 years ago, although not considered progressive tonight in Philadelphia, I'm glad to say, the prohibition of alcoholic liquors. But they did open the way for an expansion of freedom and equality. We hold these truths to be self-evident, reads the Declaration, that all men are created equal. As Abraham Lincoln said, you either believe that or you don't. If you do, then slavery is going to be abolished, as it was in 1865, after a war in which 600,000 Americans died. If you believe that all men are created equal, then at some point you're going to want to say women are too, as the Wyoming Territory did in 1869 and the 19th Amendment to the Constitution did in 1919. If you believe that all men are equal, you may want to guarantee equal rights in the workplace, in public accommodations, in government programs, as Congress did in 1964 and 65. The founders set America on a trajectory which got us where we are today. But a century ago, a challenge arose to the vision of the founders. It came from those who proclaimed themselves as progressives. They included Presidents Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, New Republic founder Herbert Croly, and the historian Charles Beard. Forrest MacDonald has instructed us about Beard's history. They argued that the vision of the founders was outmoded. A horse and buggy philosophy, no longer relevant in an industrial era of mass production of Model Ts and giant businesses, a time when ordinary people were helpless and needed government's guiding hand. They argued that the limitations on the power of the federal government, and particularly in the power of the executive branch, needed to be swept away, forgotten. They doubted the ability of people to govern themselves. Industrial society had just grown too complex, they said, for individuals to understand. Walter Lippmann wrote a book on public opinion in 1922 where he said the ordinary citizen simply can't understand issues. You have to have educated mandarins explain them and rationalize them for him, and like himself and his fellow members of the Harvard class of 1910. They believed that it would be more efficient for centralized, disinterested experts to administer national institutions than to let seemingly chaotic markets operate freely. The founders, in their view, were out of date. You can see what they had in mind when you look at the statues of the Federal Trade Commission building in Washington at the apex of Pennsylvania and Constitution Avenues. Statues of powerful and spirited horses being bridled and held in check by the guardians of the supposed public interest. The progressives sought to, and to a considerable extent did, thrust aside the English-speaking heritage of the founders and substituted the bureaucratic model of the German state, put in place by the authoritarian Otto von Bismarck and extolled in the United States in universities, that in the late 19th and early 20th century were really modeled on their counterparts in Germany. They saw Göttingen and the Humboldt University as their models, not Oxford and Cambridge. Charles Beard depicted the founders as nothing more than rich men out to feather the net, their own nest. This was the history that was still taught when I was in college before people had a chance to read Forrest MacDonald's books on the founders, which basically indicated that Charles Beard was a charlatan and a fraud. Am I being too rough? He was feathering his own nest, actually, because his books kept selling. But in any case, Theodore Roosevelt, who studied in Germany, Woodrow Wilson, who was awarded one of the first PhDs from one of the German-modeled universities, Johns Hopkins, and who attempted to impose the German model on Princeton, similarly preferred the German to the British tradition. One of the interesting things I find about Wilson is that he wrote, I believe it was his PhD thesis, and then as a book that was published and printed many times, a book on congressional government. He wrote a book on Congress and how it operated when he was at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. As I understand the history, he never took the train 40 miles to Washington and actually watched how Congress was in action or interviewed anybody in Congress at that time. You didn't have all the security arrangements around the Capitol either, but that was his idea of academia. The La Follette progressives, based in our most heavily German-American state, Wisconsin, similarly followed a German model. I find it kind of fascinating how the progressives followed a German model, that history was mostly suppressed in the years of World War I, where we had a rather shameful repression and of any kind of evidences of German-American culture. And the progressives kind of de-emphasized the German roots of their thinking. But they never abandoned their disparagement of the limits on government imposed by the Constitution, limits on government that were inspired by those placed on the king by Parliament in the Glorious Revolution of 1688-89. The progressives wanted to leave all that history behind. The progressives have had their way for much of the intervening of the century since they started writing in the first decade of the 20th century, or so the story usually goes. The New Deal historians, in their beautifully written and in many cases best-selling books, argued that market capitalism inevitably breaks down, and that the ensuing economic distress makes Americans more willing to support or at least accept big government programs. They argue that history is a story of progress from less government to more government. It ratchets only in one direction. In my view, and as I argued in my 1990 book, Our Country, The Shaping of America from Roosevelt to Reagan, which was read by Ken Cribb and my mother, and is available on Amazon for $4.23. In my view, the story is more complicated. Franklin Roosevelt and his early New Deal programs earned political credit, and probably deserved credit for stopping a deflationary downward spiral of the economy and restoring some order when the banks were closing, and they did not nationalize the banks. Roosevelt won re-election in 1936 by a huge margin for this achievement. But the political history of the later 1930s was a different story. And I'm fascinated by the fact that the historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr., liberal Democrat and a beautiful writer, set out to write an Age of Roosevelt series. And he wrote three books, one on the 1920s and two on the first Roosevelt term, 1933-34, 1935-36. The last of those three books was published in 1960. Mr. Schlesinger lived another, I think, 45 years. He wrote dozens of other books. He wrote very extensive diaries, which has been published. He was a very fluent and gifted writer. He never wrote about the second Roosevelt term. And I think the reason is that it wasn't his kind of story. It doesn't turn out the way that his history writing had led people to expect. In fact, if I'd been a friend of Mr. Schlesinger's, I did have one pleasant interchange with him, but not major way, I would have suggested he skip 1937, 38, and 39 and go to 1940 with Roosevelt and Churchill cooperating to oppose the Nazis and the Soviets when they were allied and kind of skip those intervening years. But if you go back and actually look at what happened in those years, it's interesting. I used to be a public opinion pollster, a political consultant. And so you thought you were kind of slumming when you invited a journalist to speak, but a political consultant. Actually, my experience in Washington over the last 38 years or so, 37 years, is that political consultants of both political parties have a higher degree of integrity and intellectual honesty than most people in journalism. There's a market test. You give your clients advice on how to win elections, and then there's an election day, and you can sort of see if your advice was good or not. And in journalism, there hasn't been such a test. You write stories that are scurrilous and not based on fact and violate national security and make Americans' lives more dangerous, and you're promoted. So in any case, but I'm going back. Polling was invented by George Gallup, and his first poll was published in October, conducted in October 1935. And if you go back to the second half of the 1930s, it's very interesting. The polling shows large majorities opposing high government spending. They're opposing taxes. They believe that the big government programs of the Roosevelt administration are preventing businesses from investing and creating jobs. They favor restrictions on labor unions, which have been given great rights to strike by New Deal legislation. they look actually a lot like the public opinion polls today. The polling evidence suggests to me, it's not conclusive proof, but I think it suggests that if the 1940 election had been decided on domestic issues, the Democrats would have lost. Roosevelt probably would not have run for a third term. But history in 1940 took a different turn. The United States was facing a grave international crisis. Hitler overran France in the June of 1940, just before the two national Republican and Democratic Party conventions were held. Hitler and Stalin were allies with Japan. They were in control or gaining control of most of the landmass of Eurasia. It was the moment in 20th century history when the world came closest to the world envisioned by George Orwell in 1984. It was a moment of supreme crisis. And in that crisis, Roosevelt was an experienced leader who had not seemed to lose his nerve under very difficult situations. The leading Republican candidates for president were a utility executive, a 38-year-old district attorney, and a lawyer in his second year in the Senate. Not exactly people who had great international experience that suggested they could handle this kind of crisis. And so while the New Deal historians paint the succession of five consecutive Democratic presidential victories as an inevitable ratification of the New Deal and an indication that voters want more government and so forth, I think that's a misreading or at least an oversimplification of the evidence there. And in fact, Roosevelt was reelected in 1940 and I think in 1944 on foreign policy issues and as a war president. Even so, Roosevelt's dreams of a government that guaranteed citizens jobs and health care and housing, dreams that he sketched out specifically in his 1944 State of the Union address, anticipating the end of the war, those policies were rejected by the American people. Even as Great Britain was voting in June, July 1945 to embrace the Labor Party and the socialist welfare state, the Beveridge Report, the United States voted the other way. In the 1946 election, held after the war and after Roosevelt's death, Americans voted in a Republican Congress, which actually Harry Truman called a do-nothing Congress. In fact, it did quite a lot. It substantially limited the power of labor unions in the Taft-Hartley Act. It abolished wage and price controls, which the Democrats wanted to continue indefinitely as they were continued in Britain until the 1950s. It lowered taxes at least a little bit and opposed big government housing and education programs. These policies basically proved largely enduring, even though the Republicans did not win most congressional and presidential elections in subsequent years. America took a very different course. It was offered a path towards a bigger government in that period after the war. It decided not to go in that direction. Yes, the transfer programs like Social Security and Medicare achieved widespread acceptance, but that was largely because, at least as they were portrayed, there was a nexus between effort and reward. People believed they received benefits only because they paid taxes. Americans have tended pretty consistently to reject programs which pay people for doing nothing. This was a response to the anti-poverty and welfare programs put into effect in the Great Society of the late 60s and early 70s. The New Deal chroniclers, who argue that history inevitably moves left, that history is a story of progress from less to more government, were caught off guard by one development after another. By the deregulation programs of the 1970s and 80s, which freed up vast areas of the American economy from the stultifying, hold-everything-in-place policies of progressive and New Deal regulation. By the bounteous prosperity unleashed by the Reagan tax cuts in the 1980s, the liberal democratic macroeconomists told us that couldn't happen anymore. Americans just had to get used to low growth, high inflation situation and, you know, be adults and take their medicine. Turns out they were wrong about that. The New Deal chroniclers were disproved by the reform movements, interestingly, starting in states and cities, not so much in Washington, by the centralized elites. Welfare reform pioneered by Governor Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin in 1987. Crime control reform pioneered by Mayor Rudy Giuliani in New York in 1994. Policies that were copied or adapted by many others, most of them Republicans, but some Democrats as well, and reforms that produced extraordinary results, benefiting most those living in central city, high crime, high welfare neighborhoods. People sometimes ask me why I moved in my putatively adult life from being a liberal to a conservative, and the one word answer I come up with is Detroit, where I grew up and where I worked for the mayor. I worked for the liberal mayor in the summer of 1967. We had a riot. I was at what we called the command center that was not in command of anything, and for six nights as the city was destroyed, and I saw the effect of those programs on the city of Detroit. We had wanted to create a sort of heaven for poor people in the central city. Instead, the result of those policies was to produce something more resembling hell. And I think that's a lesson that the American people have taken into account, and that we have had, that conservatives and Republicans mostly, though some Democrats as well, have had genuine public policy successes. And of course, that has had the result it sometimes has in the political dialogue, which is when you solve a problem satisfactorily, people say, fine, now what's the next issue? We're not going to vote for you for this cut crime and welfare anymore because it's already down. The conceits of the progressives were also exposed by intellectual ferment. It became apparent that centralized experts weren't entirely disinterested and neutral, but sort of always sought to expand their power, as people like Milton Friedman, James Buchanan taught. It became clear that central planners can never have the kind of information that's translated instantly, as Friedrich von Hayek observed way back in the 1940s, by price signals in free markets. It turned out that centralized experts are not as wise, and ordinary Americans are not as helpless as progressives thought. Or at least it turned out that Americans are not as malleable and as obedient as the Germans in the country where many of the progressive theories first came from. In any case, history seemed to be moving in a different direction than the progressives predicted, and things seemed to be going along in a direction. Then came the politics of the second half of this decade. Period that I call a period of open field politics, where voters are moving around, politicians are moving around. There's a lot of rapid change in volatile opinion. We had the election of Barack Obama in 2008 by a 53-46% margin. That's the largest percentage margin for any president last 20 years. It was combined with significant Democratic gains in congressional elections. In 2006 and 2008, so the Democrats essentially got up to 60 votes, a supposedly filibuster-proof margin in the Senate, and 257 votes in the House of Representatives, a solid majority there where the party leadership usually prevails given the rules that the House operates under. We heard from the political philosopher James Carville that this was the beginning of a 40-year period of natural Democratic majorities. I'm actually a little skeptical that parties have natural majorities, but Mr. Carville was pretty sure of it, and those kind of predictions had a certain amount of plausibility. Young voters favored Obama by a 66-32% margin. That's a bigger margin and a bigger divergence from older voters than we've ever seen, at least since we started doing exit polls. Voters 30 and over favored Obama by only a 50-49% margin, which suggests in retrospect that the right strategy for Republicans was to pass a constitutional amendment raising the voting age to 35 and denying the vote forever to anybody born after 1979 with the exception of a few people in this room. It's too late for that solution, but that, you know, we're going to have a generation that was totally devoted to the Obama. Minorities, blacks voted 95% for Obama, Hispanics voted 67% for Obama. They seemed, at least Hispanics, seemed likely to be an ever larger part of the electorate in the years ahead. One out of six people under 18 counted in the 2000 census was classified as Hispanic, for example. The Republican Party was in grave disrepute, and for at least in some cases, good reason. Obama and the Democrats had the enthusiastic support of university, media, financial, and corporate elites. They raised far much more money in the from ordinary voters than the Republicans, and they raised far more money on Wall Street and from the financial industry than Republicans. Obama and the Democrats came into office with the assumption, and it was an assumption shared not only by Democrats but by many other people, an assumption inherited, I think, from the New Deal historians like Arthur Schlesinger, that economic distress would make Americans more favorable to big government policies and programs. They set out to expand the size and scope of government more than has been done since World War II, since the path to welfare state socialism was blocked by the Republican Congress elected in 1946. They've had some success in changing public policy. In 2009, they passed a stimulus package that substantially increased government spending and set, you know, the budget baseline. They increased the budget baselines for a bunch of programs that they favored, which is something that's actually usually very hard to do in the congressional budget-making process. And in last month, in March 21st, they passed a health care bill that seems likely to, that seems to threaten to, reshape one-sixth of the national economy. They haven't had complete success. They failed to pass the card check bill, effectively abolishing the secret ballot in union elections. But they've managed to give something to the unions on the side. One-third of the stimulus package money was given to state and local governments, which is largely an effort to insulate public employee union members, who most union members in this country, by the way, now are public employees, from the distress that afflicted the majority of Americans who were in the private sector economy. But they've met enormous public resistance. And this has been a surprise. It's been a surprise to mainstream media. It's been a surprise to some extent to me and to others, conservative commentators. But there's no doubt they have. In numerous polls, we've seen the results of the gubernatorial elections in Virginia and New Jersey in November, in which the issues were roughly congruent with those at the federal level. We saw in January 2010 the special Senate election in Massachusetts, in which Republican Scott Brown won the Senate seat held for 47 years by Edward Kennedy. Polls on the generic ballot question. This is the question of which party's candidate you're going to vote for Congress. Show the biggest Republican advantage since Gallup began asking the question in 1950. In fact, most of the time, that question tends to understate the support Republicans actually get in House elections. For example, Republicans were behind in the generic ballot question in the elections from 96, 98, 2000, 2002, and 2004, even though in those elections they won a majority of House seats and they won pluralities of majorities of popular vote for the House. In fact, what you're looking at right now, the latest Real Clear Politics average, I think, is 46-43 Republicans ahead of Democrats. This is really quite extraordinary. I've been following congressional elections closely for the last 50 years. I've been getting paid to do so for the last 39 years. And during that time, I've never seen the Democratic Party in worse shape. The big government programs of the Obama administration have proved more unpopular than any legislation I can think of since the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. And I wasn't around to cover the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. And I think Forrest McDonald was not around covering the Kansas-Nebraska Act of 1854. But, you know, the analogy is interesting. The Kansas-Nebraska Act stimulated tens of thousands of Americans to become involved in politics. It stimulated the creation of the Republican Party, which had not previously existed, which then jumped to winning half the seats in the House of Representatives in the elections held that year. It stimulated, very importantly, the reentry into politics of a former one-term congressman from downstate Illinois named Abraham Lincoln. And it stimulated also Lincoln to invoke the language and example of the founders and to apply their arguments, their principles, to the issues of the day. And I think what we're seeing today, fascinatingly, is that the programs of the Obama Democrats have stimulated thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of newcomers, symbolized by the Tea Party movement, but also town halls, people involved in various other ways, to bring the words of the founders back into contemporary political dialogue. This has been a really spontaneous phenomenon. I mean, the Obama Democrats in the White House, who are used to summoning up crowds of union members with the purple SEIU T-shirts, Karl Rove tells me that you can tell if he's doing a lunchtime speech, they all leave at 2 o'clock because the SEIU only pays him for 2 hours. And they walk away and say, goodbye, Mr. Rove. Nice to see you today. I'm voting Republican. The Democrats said, well, these people are just being manipulated. They're astroturf. They're doing this because their health insurer is calling them up. I don't think that's a very likely scenario. What they're asking you to believe is that some individual is at home and they get a telephone call and the nice old lady says, hi, I'm calling from Aetna, your health insurance company, and I would like you to go to the town hall your congressman is holding and object to the health care bill. I can assure you that that's not the way that people are motivated to engage in politics, to become involved, This is something I didn't anticipate a year ago. I'm supposed to, my job is to try and anticipate and understand what's going to happen next. This has taken me by surprise, and I think it's the most momentous developments of the last 15 months. And it's had a huge impact, in my judgment, on the political landscape. I mean, one of the things that's important in our politics today is not just the balance of opinion, but the balance of enthusiasm. Who's motivated to turn out to vote? We've had a decade of rising turnout. We had 105 million people vote in 2000, 122 million in 2004, 131 million in 2008. And the balance of enthusiasm has shifted in that time. In 2002 and 2004, it favored the Republicans. There was a lot of enthusiasm among Democrats, which the mainstream media covered very well. It turned out there was even more enthusiasm among Republicans. The mainstream media did not cover that at all because they just don't know any Republicans. They can't imagine why anybody would be enthusiastic for them. 2006 and 2008, very different picture. Huge enthusiasm, much of it negatively expressed towards George W. Bush among Democrats. Zero enthusiasm among Republicans, and we saw the results of those elections. In 2009 and 2010, the balance of enthusiasm has swung back, very much stronger on the Republican side or against the Democrats, very weak among the Democrats, and particularly among young voters and black voters who turned out and voted large percentages for Barack Obama in 2008. I think that what's fascinated me most of all about the Tea Party people is that they, like Abraham Lincoln and the first Republicans in 1854, in their response to the Kansas-Nebraska Act, have summoned up the language and image of the founders. They've become reenactors, dressing up in 18th century costume on occasion, but they've been talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. They've been talking about the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. I can tell you that in the days when I was a political pollster, if you'd asked my boss, should we put the 10th Amendment on the on the poll, he would say, why do you want to do that? I'll be 99% not sure. Now people are talking about the 10th Amendment, and this is something that has really come spontaneously from the people. I think it's a tremendously heartening and, to me, tremendously surprising development. And our politics, I think, which was once, you know, in the George Bush era, it was a debate over Iraq, it was a debate over abortion, it was a debate over perhaps who should have done what about Hurricane Katrina, or about, you know, Congressman Mark Foley calling the House pages late at night. It's changed now. Our politics has quite suddenly and unexpectedly become a debate between the ideas of the founders, who favored the expansion of liberty, and the progressives who favored the expansion of government. It's a battle between those who want to advance a culture of dependence and those who insist on maintaining a culture of independence. It's not just an argument about, in the words of the political scientist Paul Lazarsfeld, who gets how much when. It's an argument about the character of our civic culture, not an argument about the character of our country. The progressives and the Obama Democrats assumed that people need safety nets, would welcome dependence on government. The public's clear rejection of the Democratic health care bills and the stimulus bills and other legislation has shown that this assumption is unwarranted. Americans today prefer independence to dependence on government, just as they did 200 years ago. We have not become continental Europeans yet. The policy and political and policy consequences of this argument are not yet clear. But I think in a contest between the founders and the progressives, we're going to continue to come out on the side of our founders. Even as our universities downplay the importance of the founding, as they replace historians of that period like Bernard Bailyn and Gordon Wood with scholars of transgressive feminist deconstruction or whatever the latest fad is, the American people have shown a hunger and a thirst for the wisdom that the founders provide. They have made bestsellers of books by historians, academic and non-academic, on Benjamin Franklin, George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton, the people who were gathered here in Philadelphia in 1776 and 1787. When John Adams is the beach book of the summer, you know that something is going on with Americans. They are hungry for more information and for more knowledge about the founders and about the kind of information that the group sponsoring this Philadelphia Society meeting provide and which this society is dedicated to. And I think the language and the arguments of the founders still speak to us clearly today. They sound up to date. All men are created equal. Sounds pretty good. Unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That sounds really kind of contemporary. In contrast, you look at the progressive writers, they talk about the industrial eras, mass product, the Model T, is that up to date? They're talking about an America that sounds increasingly antique and tinny. And their belief in centralized planning, I think, seems naive in a time when we live with one unpredicted innovation after another has changed our lives for the better. The culture of dependence, if you look at the election returns, continues to appeal somewhat to black Americans, most of them, though not very much to the white working class that seems to resist it. And if you look on the political map, the people who seem to be resisting it most of all are the descendants of the Scots-Irish who settled in the Appalachian chain going south, southwestern Pennsylvania, down the Appalachian chain, down to Alabama, and westward and southwest to Oklahoma and Texas. The gal from CNN they're against the stimulus package, and when the gal from CNN says, well, but you're getting a $400 rebate, I think their reaction is, you're not buying me for $400. You can take your, I won't go any farther than that. and so forth. This is, we see the culture of dependence appeals to some people who are the purported beneficiaries of it. If you look at the election returns in Virginia, New Jersey, Massachusetts, what fascinates me is that the biggest crowd for it right now are what the New York Times columnist and my friend David Brooks calls the educated class, by which he means a group smaller than the group of diploma holders in America, but the group of people that feel that they, by virtue of their superior something or other, are entitled to govern us. That the educated class, the people who feel that they will, their kind, will control the society through centralized planning, through elite credential mandarins, they're sticking with the culture of dependence. They're the main constituents of it, in fact. The culture of independence, and I think you can see it on the electoral map, and you can see it in the public opinion polls, appeals much more to the vast majority of Americans who understand viscerally, if not in scholarly detail, that we are the fortunate inheritors of a tradition of the expansion of liberty, a tradition that goes back to the Glorious Revolution and that was expressed most vibrantly by the founders here in Philadelphia, and which is happily still alive and kicking today. Thanks very much.